We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. On today's episode, Silly Resistance in the Harry Potter series. Welcome to Potterversity. On today's episode, we're talking with Mark Anthony Lewis about Silly Resistance in the Harry Potter series. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Emily Strand of Potterversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, director of campus ministry at Ohio Dominican University, and with Katie, co-editor of Potterversity, Essays Exploring the World of Harry Potter.
On today's episode, we are going to dive into the relationship between humor and resistance to authoritarianism in the Harry Potter series. Now, Emily, here's my question for you. You seem like a mischievous sort to me. Have you ever used humor as a kind of technique to challenge authority or bring it down to size?
So, yes. And
do you want to keep those under wraps?
No, but names may have to be changed to protect the innocent. So I actually, this is, if this person hears this story, they will know exactly that this is told with great affection. But I did used to work for someone who was very meticulous and maybe on bad days a little micromanagey, you know, and liked things a certain way, and sometimes that got oppressive for myself and others. So we used to play practical jokes on that person. And I may have been the ringleader. They were designed to make them uncomfortable in the very ways that we knew annoyed them. So I won't give details because that was, but now I'm thinking about it. And now I'm like, yeah, that was actually resisting the authority that I thought was coming in this package that was too oppressive to manage. And so like the Christmas poinsettias at the campus where I worked at, there were many of them, and we kind of kept them back until Christmas. But this person was off in an official capacity doing something very important, and when they weren't in their office, we filled their office with all the poinsettias. So, like, and I'm talking about like 300 poinsettias.
Oh my!
One office. And so we came back, and then I stopped in and I said, "Hey," and they're eating their lunch, you know, and all I see is eyes because there's just poinsettias everywhere. Oh. And I'm like, "Hey, you know, these poinsettias are nice, but don't you think some other people would like to enjoy them too?"
Oh. Ooh, very cheeky.
Anyway, so there were things like that we did.
Right.
There were lots of fun. And actually, the person took them in a wonderful spirit and learned to laugh at themselves. So, I mean, already knew how to laugh at themselves, but was invited to do that. So, Katie.
That's a gentler form of.
I hope so.
Yes. But humor, yes, it can be disarming in that way,
yes.
Right? That's,
yes.
You know, very, very Harry Potter. Being disarming. So
what about you? Is that your MO?
Yeah, no, it's not. My MO is to be very direct and self-righteous. So I wish I were better at that stuff. But you know who I love is Alexandra Petrie, who writes for The Washington Post. And she writes these, like, suspicious, satirical.
Oh, wow.
They're so amazing. So, and I just, I'm on the enjoy side. I enjoy watching people do that.
Totally fair.
I also enjoy John Oliver. You know, John Oliver will do these stunts where, you know, he will, you know, buy up a particular website name so that he can totally undercut some organization that's doing horrible things.
Yes.
For example. And so I think, you know, I enjoy those. I'm part of the public who appreciates that.
Yeah, I do too. My choice in late night shows is definitely, I'm a big Stephen Colbert fan.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, like the news can be so oppressive, and to find the humor in it and to laugh at it and to mock it sometimes, mm-hmm. it's just like exactly what I need at, you know, late at night. So
yeah.
It like helps me be able to go to bed and get up the next day and, you know, carry on.
Right. And, you know, we've talked about humor in Harry Potter before, but I don't think we talked about it in this particular way in any depth. And I'm really interested for us to explore some of these questions about why humor is effective when we're in an environment that we feel is repressive, or we're confused, or things are very difficult. And we have a wonderful expert here joining us today to help us navigate this question and sort of ponder it, particularly in regards to the Harry Potter series, but in a way that I think we will inevitably come up with things that help us understand it in our own world. So joining us today is Mark Anthony Lewis. He is a friend of ours from the Harry Potter Academic Conference. He has presented there many times, and he works in communication at Brown University, received his master's in professional writing from University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, and he is a practicing stand-up comic in the Boston area. Mark Anthony also wrote a chapter in our Potterversity book called Uncle Remus's Shack, Tokenism in the Wizarding World. So, serious scholar and stand-up comic. Thanks for joining us.
Seriously
on the show,
funny.
Mark Anthony.
Seriously. Hello, how you guys doing? Surely you can't be serious.
We are, and don't call me Shirley. Yes. Mark Anthony, thank you for joining us on the show. And can I ask you the question that I asked as the warm-up? Have you ever used humor directly to challenge authority?
Yeah, of course. So I this was an attempt at humor, and it didn't work out the way I planned. But I live in New England. I drive through Massachusetts all the time, and rural parts of Massachusetts. And one day in the pandemic, I was driving down a country road, and there was a house in, I want to remind you, Massachusetts, that was covered in Confederate flags.
Woof.
Which, given this town, was not immediately surprising, but I was just the irony of a house in Massachusetts feeling the need to show pride for the South, which I didn't quite have the logic of. So I talked to my friends about it, and I thought a good way to challenge this would be to call up local Civil War reenactors.
Yes.
Because
yes, it is.
I couldn't walk on their property and say you need to take those flags down. That would not turn out the way I would want it. And I couldn't say like, hey, what's with this flag? So I thought if I got local Civil War reenactors to show up in their Union garb and present them with the correct American flag.
Oh my God, I love this so much.
Yeah, it would have been a great story if it happened. They never responded. I called it Massachusetts and Rhode Island. I sent them emails. It was the middle of the pandemic, so I don't know if maybe that had something to do with it. But I never got any response from them. Messaged them on social media, sent them emails. Just no response from Massachusetts to Rhode Island.
They're like, that's not actually part of our mission.
And I don't know. Which side they represent when they were an act. So,
oh my gosh, that's cool. That would have been a lot of fun. Again,
I
would
take lots of pictures though
on the sidelines. Oh yes, yes. Well, Mark Anthony, help us understand a little bit about humor itself, and like you, I'm sure you're having to dissect this all the time as a stand-up comic. What makes something funny?
What makes something fun? I mean, I have no idea. I practice. I don't do research. But I think anybody who's looked into humor at all is probably familiar with the benign violation theory. I think you've talked about it in this podcast before with Louise Freeman. The theory is that what makes something funny is that it has to be a benign violation. It needs to be something unexpected, some sort of violation, but a safe violation. So something like, I think most of us, maybe I'm revealing a bit about myself, but I think a lot of people laugh when someone trips, but only when we know they're okay.
Right. I just laughed at you saying somebody tripping.
Me too. I was like, yeah. Yeah, but you, like, if you think about like those America's Funniest Home Videos things, they do right. often show you the clip until the person gets up because right. you want to know that person is okay.
Right.
I have watched it enough to know that.
It needs to be benign. It's somebody, right. if someone trips and then falls down a well and dies, that's not funny.
No.
Or maybe, I don't know, maybe it depends on your sense of humor, but.
Who the person is.
But if they get up and say, I'm okay. Yeah, then we can laugh.
Then that's funny. Yeah, I just took a face plant this week. I had a week, y'all. Oh. I was laying down. I go into school. It's like 7:15. I'm walking down the block. I have my briefcase. I have my big lunch box. I have plates for capstone presentations. I have this giant bag of cookies and brownies for the capstone. So I'm laying down, and my toe must have hit something, and I went flying forward, and I just was on my stomach. I did keep my face up, which was, that made it benign, right? I was okay. And I was wearing this big puffy coat. This puffy coat, it's like being wrapped in bubble paper. I was like, I think I have to wear this all the time. Mm-hmm. So I was like lying there on the ground for a minute. And then I thought, did anybody see that? Are they over there laughing? Because I bet that was hilarious. I bet it was really funny watching all my stuff, you know, bang, and I was spread eagle. So yeah. I bet it was funny. And the fact that I was not hurt made it okay. And I sort of even laughed at myself a little bit on that. Yeah.
Part of the funniness of that is the embarrassment. It's not that you got hurt. It's that you looked around to say,
yeah,
did anyone notice? Is my ego okay?
Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's right. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So this theory of benign violation, I guess it's Tom Veach or Veach, but also Peter McGraw and Caleb Warren. You sent us a little clip about that. I did my homework that you assigned me, Mark Anthony. And one of the things they talk about is like tickling. So it's a little bit like an attack, but it's benign. But they also say that this is, you know, why you can't tickle yourself is that it's not an attack. So there's no violation there. Mm-hmm. But if like some stranger came and tried to tickle you, you would be like, heck no. Right. So it would not be benign. So that you can sort of see that there's a contextual part that contributes to whether it's benign or whether it's a violation, who's doing it, what's your context. So it seems simple, benign violation, but it's complicated to figure out what's benign and what is a violation.
It's great you say the word context too, because context is so important with any sort of joke, that understanding that like we talked about with someone tripping, the context of that person got up afterwards and was okay is so important. You minimize that context and it's not funny anymore, or you expand that context and let us know that person that tripped was the prime minister of X country, and seeing that person of authority being taken down.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It makes it funnier.
How many times do people show that Biden tripping down the airplane steps?
Or tripping up the steps.
Oh, was it up? Was it up? Obviously, I didn't really watch it.
or have you guys seen the clip of Pete Hegseth, or is that his name? The guy who's been nominated for Secretary of Defense. Throwing an axe. He was supposed to throw an axe and hit a target, and it like flew way over the target and hit this musician.
In the middle of New York City, throwing axes.
But the musician was okay.
Like, well, I'm not actually sure, because like the musician kind of backed up and was like holding his arm.
He's okay now. He's joined the headless hunt.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
The armless hunt.
Right. But especially when people who are authority figures look ridiculous, you know? And as we were talking about this and sort of thinking, so as we segue to thinking about the, you know, what makes something funny, and particularly the politics of what makes something funny and how we can use it maybe against authority, or to bring authority down to size, I was thinking about the Dada movement, which I teach about in class. This starts during the Great War, during World War One, and they were absurdists, and so they poked fun at a lot of things that were supposedly sacred. I mean, things like art. So out of the Dada movement, you got people like Duchamp, who took the Mona Lisa and put a mustache and goatee, and you know, that is just a little way of like tweaking Leonardo, the greatest artist of the Western world, right? Just a little. Right,
take him down a peg.
Take him down a peg. But they also did things like, they did like an image, I think it was like a photograph of important German leaders, but in their swim trunks in the sea, in the ocean. You know, and they, you know, they would take people and they put them in their military uniforms, but the heads, they would change into pig masks. Okay. So like kind of funny, but also it's pointed. It's, you know, making a pretty strong point. And so I was thinking about how the Dada, it used humor and absurdism for this larger critique of authority and, you know, the values that people in the Europe had sort of seemed to champion that were revealed as illusions. And in a way, it felt like truth-telling, you know, but truth-telling through humor. And I just thought about that as you were talking, Mark Anthony.
I think there's was a movement, I think, maybe like 10 years ago, where a lot of comedians, or not just comedians, but just I think American culture in general, we started to look at comedians as being kind of important figures in society. People like Jon Stewart got really important when, depending on who was president. We had people like George Carlin, who died and became sort of revered and almost kind of sanctified after his death. And then we looked at people like, I'm going to say a name here, and maybe our feelings about him currently are different than they were maybe 10 years ago, but someone like Dave Chappelle, who was ridiculing American culture in a way that became kind of serious. And we looked at comedians as truth tellers and like speaking truth to power. Mm-hmm. And the phrase I think a lot of comedians now make fun of that we all used was modern day philosophers, or which I think most people that call comedians modern day philosophers are not familiar with the PH and PhD stands for. I think those are modern day philosophers. They have it in their title. But
I was thinking about, you know, there's that old phrase that the only person who can speak truth in the presence of the king is the jester.
Right.
And the jester can speak truth because it is in a humorous tone, but it is still truthful.
Because he's the lowest member of society also.
Right.
So he's non-threatening. That's a story that we love, and it's a myth that comedians love to perpetuate. I don't know how true it is, but there's definitely an aspect of the comedian as the lowest, as a person on the lowest totem pole, the lowest position on the totem pole, can speak truth to power to the king because he's non-threatening. Mm-hmm. And it's, in rhetorically speaking, that makes him not an actor of change, but someone who inspires change in other people. The action doesn't come from the jester. The action comes from the people listening to the jester, and saying, let me think about this. Is that something we should be considering doing?
Yeah, the fool. And you know, we spoke with Ian Desher about his adaptations, his Shakespearean adaptations of Star Wars. And, you know, that's, he fixed the Phantom Menace because, you know,
didn't have any humor in it?
depending on what you like, he made Jar Jar the fool, which means, you know, the wisest character, but putting on this act, you know, as if he's stupid and has no real actual control over his tongue reflexes. I don't know. I kind of wish they could have gotten that into the film a little bit.
Yeah, definitely would have improved. Right. Yeah, I think that would be a great addition to the Jar Jar character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mark Anthony, why do you think we so often want to hear from comedians when times are tough or when we're confused? Because I feel like, a lot of times, like, for example, like right after the election, there was a lot of pressure on the host of Saturday Night Live. Like, whoa, he's a comic. Like, what's he going to say about the election? And then when he didn't really say anything, wah, wah, and people were kind of upset about that. So why do we want to hear from comedians when, troubling things are happening?
Right, right. I think part of that is maybe, in my personal opinion, partially an over-responsibility on comedians. I think a responsibility that some comedians have taken on themselves, like I mentioned Dave Chappelle before, who kind of has been taken himself maybe a little too seriously for a comedian, for a jester. But I think partially also, we live in a time period where it seems every few months there's some sort of tragedy happening. Mm-hmm. And so we need that levity, and we need comedians to come out and let us know that everything's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. I think maybe the point, Bill Burr was the host of Saturday Night Live right after the election. And I think everyone looked back at the last time Trump was elected president, and the monologue for Saturday Night Live was actually Kate McKinnon dressed up like Hillary Clinton playing Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah.
Yeah, that was not funny.
No,
it was not funny.
It was weird, and it was a little self-serious, and it was just not funny. And people were hoping that Bill Burr is someone who's kind of a truth teller. He's someone with comedians pretend to have no filter. We do have a filter, but we play with that lack of filter. And Bill Burr is someone who especially plays with that lack of filter and says things that are not appropriate to say in public, but maybe we kind of hope that someone would say. And his jokes fell flat because we didn't feel like he was speaking what's in our hearts that we were afraid to say out loud in public. And maybe that's where people thought it was lackluster or just kind of fine, but didn't evolve into this big thing that made everyone sigh of relief.
Yeah, right. Catharsis somehow by thinking about putting something, troubling or weird or, in a humorous lens, so that you can really, maybe it helps, gives a little distance or perspective when you're looking at something humorously.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just artists in general, not just through jokes, but any form of art, we like art and we like storytelling because it helps us put our lives in a context that's manageable. Mm-hmm. It helps us look at life and say, I'm stressing out, or there's so much going on, I don't know what I can do. And then a story or a painting or a joke can help us take something large and absurd and see the absurdity in it and kind of bring it down to a level that's more manageable and like, okay, I can place this in context and I can understand it and I can move on with my day and I can move on with my life because I can handle it.
We human beings, we just need some joy, even when we don't necessarily think we're allowed to feel it. And that kind of humor, I think, gives us permission to find a little nugget of joy. Like I have a text thread with some women in my life who are very important to me. And like, we just fill that sucker with funny memes constantly as a way to cope. And, we give each other a little, and I'm constantly using the haha emoji on that, or the crying sideways emoji, right?
Don't you get like some kind of like a chemical boost from laughter, exactly. I a lot of times when I watch The Late Show, Stephen Colbert will say something that I upon hearing the news earlier that day or the day before, that I thought in my head, but didn't actually have a chance to say to anyone. After the election, I thought to myself, well, at least we'll have a peaceful transfer of power, And I kind of chuckled to myself. And then that night on the show, that's exactly what first things he said. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it's great because I'm just like, a lot of times when I'm watching that show, I don't even really laugh out loud. I just go, uh-huh, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, exactly. That's uh-huh. exactly right, you know. Yeah. And it's, you know, there's something about that. But then sometimes I do belly laugh because he's a very funny individual. And especially if he starts dancing, just the dance is just really great. And the way he uses the frame, you know. You're right. It's something about someone else saying for you what you know needs to be said. You know, and there's right. irony too. There's humor a lot of times plays on irony, you know, and you could be shocked and disturbed by irony, or you could be amused by it too, right. you know, and so I think that also plays in.
And juxtaposition, placing, I think juxtaposition is maybe another way to say context, like we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. Juxtaposing, tripping with a person of power, there's mm-hmm. humor in that juxtaposition, and something we see a lot with, the rise of Comedy News, who Stephen Colbert kind of comes out of, is they often use juxtaposition. They'll take a current events topic and they'll juxtapose it with maybe a previous statement by that same authority figure, or they'll juxtapose it with something that shows the absurdity of the original thing by placing mm-hmm. it in that new context.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I do love about the Harry Potter books is that they
I wondered if we were going to talk about
genuinely funny. Right. I know.
Is the one he's son of like Greek gods or something?
He's got a sword made of light. is that it?
But one of the reasons I could never get into the Casual Vacancy, like there's just no humor really.
Yeah.
Like not that I, but the Harry Potter books are delightful because there is this humorous quality to them. That Rowling taps into. And when you look at some of the authority figures, like look at Cornelius Fudge, like
right.
just the name.
Yeah. His name is Fudge.
Yeah. And then, right. And then like with his little green bowler hat and the, you know, the things that he says that are so ridiculous. And so there, I think there are, we can see that the books, they're not just unalloyed, like fantasy seriousness, which I think a lot of fantasy stories are quite serious and don't have a sense of humor about themselves. But the Potter books, I think they are deliberately humorous in a way that is a little subversive. You know, that's
yeah.
sort of the idea behind the humor there. Another piece of homework that you gave us, Mark Anthony, which I believe I did my homework. Emily.
Yes, Emily. I did some other things.
Right. So, but it was, it's a, just a little essay.
I didn't read most of the homework I gave you also. So it's
yes. Well, that's classic professorial behavior.
I wanted to be surprised. Right. Okay.
Okay. Well, let me tell episode. You, I'm the Hermione here, I guess. So it's this little essay. It's very readable, very short, by George Orwell called Funny, Not Vulgar. Funny, but not vulgar. And he wrote it in 1945, and there's a wonderful line in there where he says, every joke is a tiny revolution.
Yeah.
Every joke is a tiny revolution. And then he says this, if you had to define humor in a single phrase, you might define it as dignity sitting on a tin tack. Whatever destroys dignity and brings down the mighty from their seats, preferably with a bump, is funny. And the bigger they fall, the bigger the joke. It would be better fun to throw a custard pie at a bishop than at a curate, which I think
right.
is itself
yes.
funny. Yeah, so, right, but, you know, this is Orwell, right, in 45, who's basically saying, like, this is what we need. And he, in this little essay, he's talking about how, you know, British writers used to be funny in the time of Dickens, for example, but that they kind of have lost it since the late 19th century. But then I think, like, he didn't know Monty Python was coming.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and
right.
Monty Python really, it's very, like, the Ministry of Silly Walks. Like, I play that for my class because it's such a send-up of a kind of British authority and, mm-hmm. you know, administrative authority that was so characteristic of the 70s. And so I think, it was maybe waiting for its moment to come.
I think something Orwell's tapping into is a subversiveness. And satire is that
yeah.
it's if I could do another quote here from the essay, he says, He defines a thing as funny when, in some way that is not actually offensive or frightening, it upsets the established order. So he's kind of playing with that benign violation theory there, but he's also adding an element of subversiveness to it. To him, his definition of funny is it's got to subvert authority in some way. It's got to subvert the established order in some way.
And his problem with the more recent humor that he saw was that it was trying to cozy up to authority too much.
Right.
And I think there have been some critiques of, say, the White House Correspondents' Dinner that have suggested mm-hmm. that's one of the problems, that comedians are too cozy with these authority figures that they're supposed to actually be critiquing. And so right. they're not really delivering the truth bombs the way we want our jesters to do.
Right. Emily, you were mentioning Stephen Colbert. I don't know the entire history of the White House Correspondents' Dinner and comedians' involvement in that, but the first time it came on my radar was when Stephen Colbert gave a talk at the White House Correspondents' Dinner for George W. Bush. And at the time, for younger people, you may not be aware of this, but at the time, he played a character, which I believe the pronunciation of his last name is actually Colbert. And Colbert yes. is a joke character that he yes. created.
Yeah, exactly.
and he just had to stick with it because he played that character Colbert for so long. Mm-hmm. But he played a character who was a kind of caricature of, at the time, Bill O'Reilly. A modern day example might be somebody like Tucker Carlson or mm-hmm. whoever else the person is now. I don't pay attention, but
yes. It's wise. Really.
Right. But he played this kind of right wing pundit who was very America centric and very very rah-rah. And I think some people didn't get the joke. So he was invited to the White House Correspondents' Dinner to give a speech, and he gave a very satirical, ridiculing speech of George W. Bush. And there were no laughs. Nobody laughed because it was very uncomfortable. And I think he talks about it, how he felt like he was kind of going into the lion's den. He was going into this going, I am going to completely destroy these people, and they have no idea that it's coming. And then it became kind of a tradition for comedians to use that platform to roast whoever mm-hmm. the authority figure was at the time. In recent years, I think a more famous one was Michelle Wolf, who did a White House Correspondents' Dinner, or previous to that, at Barack Obama's White House Correspondents' Dinner. That's famously why we have our soon-to-be president, because he made fun of Donald Trump because of the whole birther movement. Mm-hmm. And so he used that opportunity mm-hmm. to roast Donald Trump. And I think Donald Trump has admitted himself that at that time, that's when he decided he was going to run for president.
Yes, yes. Thank you, Mr. Obama.
Thanks
for that. Obama. No.
And then in recent years, I think in 2018, Michelle Wolf had kind of a famous, she's a stand-up comedian, and she had kind of a famous speech at the White House Correspondents' Dinner where she used the opportunity to roast Donald Trump while he was sitting president. And what I think is really interesting about her speech is that it is a roast in the tradition of a roast where you make fun of someone. But as I think a lot of comedians know, maybe not enough, is that a good roast, you have to always be in a position looking up to authority. So you have to make fun of yourself when you're roasting also. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what's really interesting about her speech is that pretty much everyone there at the White House Correspondents' Dinner was probably on the same page with her and probably would be okay with all of the things that she was saying about Donald Trump. As a skilled comedian as she is, she knew that she needed to include these kind of self-effacing jokes mixed in mm-hmm. So that we never saw her as kind of, I don't like the term punching down, but especially in this context, because she wasn't really punching down, but just being constantly on attack mode mm-hmm. rather than ridiculing herself too. She needs to stay a jester.
Right.
And the moment you take mm-hmm. yourself too seriously, you're not a jester anymore. Mm-hmm. So she has to put on the silly hat with the bells and the colorful, you know, Harlequin outfit by making fun of herself mm-hmm. a bit so that the jokes go over better.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Well, you know, this, of course, draws our attention to, I think, particularly some of the jester figures that we have in the Harry Potter stories. And I think I would, you know, there's Peeves, who seems very jester-like. But then also, I think the Weasley twins probably are those. My guess is that those would be the two that would come immediately to mind in terms of using humor as a form of resistance to authority. And Mark Anthony, I wonder what do you think about those two characters and what they're doing? And do they ever ridicule themselves in that way also as a way to keep it humorous and not just an attack?
It's funny that, I mean, that last thing you just said there made me think of a very specific scene. I think in book five, maybe, the Weasleys are testing out on Gryffindor students, the Weasleys, Wizard Weezes.
Skiving snack boxes.
The skiving snack boxes. And they're testing them out in the common room. And Hermione's very upset. And she's like, but they're technically not breaking any rules. And Harry looks over and he talks about how I think it was Neville or maybe one of the first years turns into a canary or something. And he points out exactly the point I think you made, was that it could look a little mean-spirited, the way how they're testing this out. And it seemed like Neville wasn't aware that he was going to turn into a canary. And he ends up laughing afterwards, which is, that's the benign part. Mm. But also, I think they use the snack boxes on themselves. The Weasley twins use them on themselves, and they're able to laugh at themselves. And so that makes it benign also, is that they are just as ridiculous as they're making other people. It's not punching down, as it were.
Right. No, their characters are kind of carefully crafted so that you don't realize actually that they're very smart and they're getting really good grades and they're actually very clever wizards, you know, until, you know, who is it the narrator that kind of lets that go, or somebody?
Well, Hermione is like, this is very complex magic.
Yes.
I think she might even say it about the skiving snack boxes. She's impressed.
Yes, right. But it's basically lost on everyone else.
Okay. Ron tells Harry, like, they joke around, but they do well. When Ron's, you know, feeling bad on himself, and he's saying, like, you know, Fred and George, they joke around a lot, but they do get good grades.
Mm. Right, but it's never, like, upfront and in your face, you know, and they would never claim that kind of position of you know, academic elevation over their peers, the way that Hermione just kind of naturally does.
Or
you know,
Percy, right? They ridicule Percy relentlessly with his prefect badge and all of that.
And probably it seems to be particularly Percy, too, of all their brothers, especially because he takes himself so seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Bill Weasley is just as smart or smarter than Percy, but they don't ridicule him the same way they ridicule Percy, because Bill Weasley doesn't take himself as seriously.
Right.
You can tell because he has long hair and an earring.
Yeah. So I'll just tell you something. So my brother,
he's cool.
I was telling my brother this, that we were going to record this today. And he was, I always find it interesting to see what his take is. And he said, you know, what's important is for that humor does in terms of its relationship to power is it is able to, it's able to be cool in a way that challenges the automatic coolness of the powerful. And so when you look at, you know, Fred and George, they are really cool. They're the coolest people in the school, right?
When Fred asks out Angelina to the Yule Ball.
Yes.
What's cooler than that?
Right. They're cool. And humor, their subversive humor is able to make resistance to authority cool. And of course, Draco and the Slytherins, they're attracted to the power itself, which could make them cool. But humor is the subversion of that, and also has this cool quality that is socially empowering.
Yeah. Cool. I mean, the word cool is really interesting too, because if you look at origins of that definition of the word cool, it comes from jazz, comes from black language, and really kind of the original definitions of cool. We think of cool nowadays. I don't know how you would define the modern definition of cool, but good, likable, those are connotations, those are synonyms, but the kind of the origin of that comes from cool as in relaxed, chill, cool smooth. As in
unbothered,
unflappable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's definitely the Weasleys, and that's the humor helps with that. Is that under immense pressure, you don't get angry, you don't fight back, you laugh. Mm-hmm. And there's something very cool about that.
Yeah.
And it takes away all of the power of the person who's trying to ridicule you if you laugh at yourself, or and that you don't get angry, which I think is something that maybe Harry's not that great at.
But
or Ron. Right.
Yes.
But what about, like, I was thinking about when, I guess it's George, is injured and has his ear shot off.
Right.
And he...
How do you feel, George? Are you okay? I feel holy.
Saint-like.
Is he delusional? A saint-like, that's what it was. Yeah.
Holy, get it? Right?
He's sitting there, he's in dire pain, and he's sitting there thinking up ear jokes. Like...
And clearly not thinking very hard either. But
no,
it's a weak joke, but
he's workshopping it.
It's workshopping, but it's strong because it's an I'm still here. You know, it is a way to say they didn't get me.
Yeah.
And, yes.
You know, and maybe I'm even better.
And that's an example of a joke too, where the context of it is so important, because imagine that same scenario. But Mrs. Weasley is the one who had her ear cut off.
We'd think she was crazy if she was saying that.
Or if someone said it to her. Imagine if Harry said that to Mrs. Weasley. Oh, you must feel saint-like. You know, holy, because you have...
No.
That would not be even remotely funny. I mean, I might think that was funny, but it was...
Molly Wobbles is funny, though.
Molly Wobbles is funny. That's just fun to say.
But because it's benign, right? It's silly, right. But it's, you know, there's something sweet about that.
And it's ever so slightly sexual. Which is kind of a, there's humor in that as Harry is like a surrogate son, seeing his surrogate parents use their bedroom talk with each other.
Yeah.
Oh gosh.
And the discomfort that comes from that.
Oh. Weasley bedroom talk.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Well, one of the things that I find really interesting about the Weasleys, of course, is that they, you know, they are able to use jokes and pranks as literal weapons.
Yes.
And we see that a lot against Dolores Umbridge in book 5, right?
Yeah. All throughout book 5, it's not just the Weasleys, but it's what the Weasleys inspire when they do their big finale with all of the fireworks and the giant swamp, and they escape Umbridge, who thinks that she's finally got them cornered until she finds out that actually this was part of their plan the whole time. And they escape on their brooms, and before they leave, they look back at Peeves and they say, "Give her hell from us, Peeves." And Peeves salutes, possibly the only time he's ever paid attention, taken authority from anyone else, is when the Weasleys tell him to.
Yeah, I got this. Yes. Lord of Mistral. Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely.
That is my absolute favorite moment in the 7 book series. And you know, bar none. And I have a lot of moments I love in that series.
It's so satisfying.
It is so satisfying. Because again, they're doing what we know needs to be done and saying what needs to be said and taking away her power. They're taking away her power. They're even stealing back their broomsticks, you know.
And who they deputize. They don't deputize Harry. They don't figure out who the most powerful wizard in the school. They don't deputize McGonagall, who is maybe the second most powerful person in the school,
right?
After Dumbledore, who's no longer there. They deputize Peeves because they know that he's the one who can take away her authority.
He's not even corporeal, you know.
right.
So, but let's ask this, because on the flip side, are they sometimes bullies, the Weasley twins? You know, do they do things that are bullying? I was trying to look up their pranks just to remind myself, and I found one that was I guess it was a Wizarding World story. Oh, 6 times Fred and George's pranks went too far. That's what came up when I Googled it.
Oh,
God, their headlines.
That's from the Wizarding World.
It's always a number.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess it's harrypotter.com. And so they, You know, they talk about the Peruvian instant darkness powder because right. Draco is able to just purchase that and use that as a weapon for his own side. You know, right. That's the problem with weapons, that, you know, they can be used against the wrong target. But that, let's see, what else did this article say? That when Ron was 3, they had transfigured his teddy bear into a spider, and that's why he has this fear of spiders. But there's also that incident, which we've talked about on the show before, where they drop those toffees before Dudley Dursley.
Right. The tongue-tongue toffees.
Tongue-tongue mm-hmm. toffees. And is that an act of bullying? Does this, you know, does this go too far? The other one I'll just point out, and then we can talk about them together, is when they throw the captain of the Slytherin Quidditch team into the Vanishing Cabinet.
Yeah.
And then, like, they're not concerned about what happens to him.
They say, where did he go? And they don't know. We don't know.
They're like, who cares?
Yeah.
Good luck.
And Draco says that's where he got the inspiration for getting the Death Eaters into Hogwarts, because I guess he can overhear Borgin and Burks. So they know that the cabinet in Borgin and Burks, mm-hmm. which is where Harry hides in book 2. He can hear that. So they know that those two are connected. So there's another way in which the Weasleys kind of inspire the bad guys.
Yeah. Makes me think of the correspondence dinner you were just talking about.
Right. Yeah. Unintended consequences of your behavior, of your pranks.
Yeah. But do we think that they're bullies? I mean, is that a fair charge? And is their humor, is it going too far? And what is the dividing line?
In a way, yes. I think, like you said, humor is a tool, and it can be used for good or bad. It can be used to create a common sense of feeling by making everyone laugh. It can be used to subvert authority, but it can also be used to denigrate people. Mudblood as a term is is kind of humorous way to keep people down. And, you know, bad people laugh just like good people do. It's not inherently virtuous. And so that's part of why I don't particularly like the phrase punch down. One of the reasons is because humor, jokes, comedy is not inherently virtuous. It can be used by bad people just as good people. And it can be unwieldy too. It's a difficult weapon to wield, because you may have intentions to help, but you can end up harming sometimes too. And I think the Weasleys are a good example of that with the tongue toffee. That is kind of bullying. Dudley is a bully himself, and they're maybe
right.
They're subverting authority in that way, but they're doing it in a way that I think modern readers would look back and go, well, this is kind of fat shaming, isn't it? And they're using their magical authority over a non-magic person and playing with the fact that he has no idea. It's not benign anymore, because to him, he doesn't know whether his tongue will ever go back. He doesn't know if he's going to choke on his tongue and die. To him, he doesn't know that it just takes a quick spell to go away. So it's not benign anymore. And the Marauders are kind of like that. James and Sirius.
I was going to bring them up too, because they're like the pre-Weasley twins.
Right.
In the sense that they, you know, and then the Weasley twins get the map. But the map is funny. And especially
kind of mean too.
That says about mean. Snape. Yeah. Yeah. But it's mean. And we know that the Marauders had somewhat of that role. But I think also the question is, like, who has the power? And sometimes people have a disagreement, you know? I think it's the question, does Snape have power? Were they being critical of him because he was himself a bully? Like, does Dudley have power in the sense that, you know, that they're knocking him down a peg because he was bullying Harry? But when they're magical and he's not, it's not clear who has the power in those situations. And so you can't necessarily be sure, as you say, how the joke is going to land.
Yeah, this is all making me think much more than I've ever thought about the about the power relationships that are in place, like, to prepare for something to be funny. You know, like, there has to be the right kind of power relationships going on Or it does seem like, I mean, you know, the Weasleys, like maybe it would have been funnier if Harry would have done that to Dudley, but sure. Because the twins are older and more accomplished and they're wizards and he's a muggle, you know, so you've got all these.
And they're not really dynamics. Threatened by Dudley at all. They're
no,
not
right. 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 Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. I think there's really interesting power dynamics between Snape, young Snape, and James and Sirius, where young Snape is, if we put him in real world context, he's kind of a young white supremacist. He's someone who looks up to, you could say, the KKK or something like that, and he wants to join their ranks. So in that way, you might look at him as an authority figure and somebody who's completely wrong, and he throws around racial slurs. But then you have James and Sirius, who they try to protect the weak. They are not blood supremacists, but they are also, both James and Sirius are purebloods who come from wealthy pureblood families. Snape is a half-blood who comes from a poor family who has hand-me-downs. And it's arguable, but maybe he can't afford proper grooming. And so a lot of the ways we ridicule him may have something to do with the fact that just how he grew up, and just he doesn't, there's a class difference between the two of them. So there's the dynamics of power there are so difficult to unravel. That's why I think humor is in comedy is a little more complicated than simply punching up or punching down. There's you could argue from different perspectives of whether something is punching up or punching down in that situation. And it's, you know, myself as a practicing comedian, and I to put myself in context here, I don't have a Netflix special. The first time I've had to claim it on my taxes
you don't have
was
one
last
yet.
Year.
Yet. I'm waiting.
Yet.
Give us Netflix. Let us
maybe
know.
Maybe sometime in the next years.
I'd totally
next 10
watch
years.
It.
But I've just recently started claiming it on my taxes, so I'm
that's
I'm in this semi pro.
It's a milestone.
Yes. But when I write jokes, someone familiar with the workings of comedy will know this. When you start out as a comedian, you start at open mics. You go to the diviest bar in your town, and there are a bunch of unwashed youths there, telling the most offensive jokes that they can think of to each other.
Oh boy.
yes, and that's how you start in comedy. Is you do that on a Tuesday night? You go to the diviest bar in your town. And then you'd say the most horrible things you could think of to each other. But but
charming.
The point, yes, very charming. But the point of that is to work out how a joke is going to work. You can write a joke in a notebook, but you can't perform that at a show until you've had chance to practice it in live and in front of a microphone, in front of a room full of people, because you need to figure out, is this joke going to land the way I intended it to? Or might there be a context that other people have that may change the way they receive it? Mm-hmm. So like Emily was saying, I don't know that necessarily every comedian is thinking about it in these sort of academic terms, but certainly we're thinking about it in terms of, let me try this joke out. Let me see if people like it. Let me try it out 100 times, get the wording exactly right. Figure out, where I as a speaker need to be in this story. This might be a shock to people, but most jokes are not true.
right.
Some people are confused by that, but most jokes are not true.
Right.
One of the major untruths that we do as comedians is a story that happened to someone else. We'll say it happened to us because it just makes the story more interesting if it happened to you than if it happened to someone else. And you got to figure out where the me is in that story so that people laugh at it. Am I being the villain of that story? Or am I being the hero of that story? Is it funnier if I'm the villain of that story? Is the story funnier if I'm making fun of myself and being the jerk in the story? Or is the story funnier if I'm the hero of that story and someone else is the villain? Because if I'm the villain, maybe people won't find it funny because they'll just think I'm a jerk. That's a thought process that a lot of comedians are going through when writing jokes.
Yeah, I love the idea that you're testing it against people's actual reactions.
yeah.
and it strikes me that, you know, when Rowling is writing these books. Like, she's not doing that, right? She's,
yeah,
in a way, I mean, I'm sure there are editors or what have you, but a book doesn't exactly work the same way. And I was thinking about a particular incident that I think we used to take as humorous, but maybe we've had some revision given recent events. And that is a scene we talked about with Lori Kim on a previous episode, where they're doing the Bogart exercise, Ridiculous, in Lupin's class. And Lupin pulls Neville aside and has him figure out what he's going to do to make his biggest fear, Snape, seem ridiculous. And he dresses him in his grandmother's clothes. And then when Snape comes out with the vulture hat and the handbag, and right, that's funny. It's a funny, and that's almost classic humor, right? A little, you know, gender bendy, you know, that's a, it's a send up. And so, and that, because Snape is somebody who bullies Neville and is really, I mean, Neville is genuinely afraid of Professor Snape.
Right.
And his grandmother, right? That there's something that is like funny and that works with that. But given the new context that we have, I think that moment lands differently for people who read that now. And Lori Kim was talking about it, you know, in the context of all that has happened, you know, with J.K. Rowling and statements about trans people and so on, that it's not funny for a lot of people anymore.
That moment's interesting because it's, like you say, it's classically humorous in a way where a lot of classic sketch comedy involves men, particularly because men are the ones who are able to have jobs like that. Privileged men are the ones who are able to, or historically were the ones able to dedicate their time to ridiculous efforts like comedy. And if you want to tell stories that involve women, you have to involve cross-dressing in it. Monty Python did a lot of cross-dressing. Kids in the Hall from Canada, lots of cross-dressing. So there's humor that comes from that.
MASH.
But MASH, yeah.
Sure, yeah.
But... is that humor, is it, in, remember that moment with the Boggart, it's Lupin that gives Neville the idea to have Snape dress in his grandmother's clothes. And Lupin was friends with James and Sirius, who were bullies of Snape. So does that come from a perspective of ridiculing a man by making him look like a woman? Does that humor come from, isn't it funny how sometimes men think they're women, which could be a transphobic perspective. But I think there is a benign perspective you could take from that. It could be, it's not simply that Snape is dressed like a woman. It's that he's dressed in an old woman's unfashionable clothes, which I think is not necessarily a transphobic perspective. That could be a perspective of these clothes are silly in a separate context. That's a perspective you could take. I have a friend who's a comedian friend who's trans, and she's told me before that she doesn't really like drag. She finds it kind of to be a little ridiculing. I think there are a lot of people that provide pushback on that and say that it's not that it's ridiculing femininity and in strict gender roles, not ridiculing, you know, the trans perspective, the trans experience. But there's different ways you can look at it. And that's kind of the difficult part of jokes is that, like I said, it's an unwieldy weapon. You don't know who it's going to nick.
When we're sort of thinking about it in terms of, you know, other characters, maybe there are some nice people sort of talk about Sassy Harry. And I love, this is just a classic moment, right? Where Harry, you know, Snape asks something in class, Professor Snape, and and Harry just calls out, yes. And Snape says, yes, sir. And Harry says, no need to call me sir, professor.
Oof.
Right?
Which, brutal.
That's a great moment.
Right? And we love that. I think as readers, we love that because it's just a little zing there.
And so quick. It's, Harry. I mean, you know, your reading pace is the reading pace of the reader, but it's the economy of words there. And because we can see inside Harry's head, he didn't think it. We know he didn't think, oh, I'm going to get Snape on this next one. It was an unthinking moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Are there other moments where we can see, you know, other characters, you know, using humor in that way? And again, I think it for the Harry in that moment, it is definitely a way to tweak authority and an authority that's pretty cruel to him. Are there other ones that we could point out?
Do I have to say it?
Yes,
you
say
know,
it.
You know, Pooh.
Absolutely, yeah, yes. Yeah. That's what I was thinking too.
I mean, that's, you know, it's really subversive.
Yeah, I'm going there doing. For the close quote. So
okay,
good, so, good. I'm so glad. I'm so glad. But really, the boldness and the sort of daring of it is quite intense.
The context is so important of that. It's the beginning of book six. It's most of the shops on Diagon Alley have closed. It's very dour. There are not a lot of people walking around. There's all these ministry kind of keep calm and carry on posters around saying, giving people advice that's not really super helpful, but just trying their best to make people feel like we have this under control.
And, when they don't.
Right, exactly.
It's obvious they don't. Yeah.
Very clearly don't, yeah. And the Weasley twins take that opportunity to mock those ministry approved posters, and with the You Know Pooh poster, which says who it takes down not just the ministry and ridicules the ministry, but also ridicules quote unquote You Know Who, Voldemort, saying, "Oh, he's not your real problem. Your real problem is constipation."
Yeah, like,
constipation is much worse than the murderous Nazi.
Well, right, exactly. But that is just a delightful message, you know?
Yes.
Like, that actually, no, we can carry on with our lives. Like, we can be concerned with our own concerns. You know, we don't have
right.
to. Like, somebody the other day after the election, some of my friends were panicking. And I get it. I mean, I understand why they would feel that way. But somebody was like, well, he just said, you know, go out and get a gun. Go out and get a gun because you're going to need that to protect yourself in this new world. And I was like, I kind of wasn't participating in it. And then I was like, you know what? I'm not going to be doing that because I'm into nonviolence. You know, that's my thing. I'm into nonviolence. I will not own a gun. I don't care who threatens me. I don't care who threatens my family. I don't care who threatens my neighborhood. I'm not going out and buying a gun. And I'm not going to change who I am because of somebody else. I'm not going to let that person suck all the oxygen out of the room and change who I am because of their lurid ways, you know?
Yeah.
So it is, you know, the You Know Pooh thing is kind of like, hey, you know, life goes on. Life goes on, or it doesn't, and that's a real problem, right? So, you know, get that taken care of.
That point you just made too about I'm not going to change who I am because of you, that goes back to Katie's point about cool. And that's what cool is, unflappable. You are, you can go ahead and shout at me. I'm not going to lose my cool. You can be a base human being who tries to, you know, oppress other people. I'm not going to change who I am because of that. That's cool. And that's what humor does. It subverts. It says, I'm not going to recognize your reality. I'm not going to change my reality because of what you're trying to turn it into.
Peeves also has this moldy voldy thing that he does, right? But there's not a lot of other mockery of Voldemort, is there?
No, I think no. And I maybe you'll
that's
remind
maybe
me of
why
some
you
more.
Know Pooh. You know, so
yeah,
it hits, right? It totally hits because of that. And the Moldy's Voldy's gone moldy rhyme, that's a little safer because he's disposed of, you know.
Yeah, right. That's true. It's after.
But they can't, you know, the author cannot poke too much fun at her bad guy, you know, because
true.
The reader has got to take the bad guy seriously in the end, you know. And I think the timing, like you said, Mark Anthony, about being at the beginning of book six when everything is very dire, you know, that's great timing for You Know Pooh because maybe things are getting a little too heavy, you know, and you can't let it go off that cliff either because no one's going to want to keep reading. It's just like gloom and doom, right? But you know, the author does have to make sure that there's not too much levity surrounding the bad guy because he really is quite bad, you know, so that we believe it and we're compelled to keep reading.
Yeah. That makes me think of my you recently did an episode on where you mentioned peeves and what peeves is he a ghost or not? And I was listening. I do listen to this
Thank you.
podcast. Of
We
course, like
appreciate
and
you,
subscribe.
listener.
We guess. But it made me think of my working theory of Peeves is that he is kind of the embodiment of the adolescent spirit of Hogwarts. He's kind of he's born from that. You know, you get a bunch of adolescents together, and magic's just kind of gonna create a being like Peeves. And if you look at who Peeves bows to as an authority figure and who he doesn't, and I think the narrator says a few times that one of the sole figures that Peeves will ever listen to is the Bloody Baron. And what is it about the Bloody Baron that that Peeves will bow to? And I think it's because he is frightening, he's scary. And Peeves is afraid of the Bloody Baron. And it there's a I think there's a really important dynamic at play there between jokes, humor, and fear. If you look at horror movies, they almost always incorporate some element of humor in them in some way because you need that tension release or it's
Right,
just too
here's
dour.
Johnny.
Yeah,
Right?
yeah.
Ah!
Yeah. There are small moments of humor throughout horror movies, and it's I think those are the two emotions that fight each other the most are joke, humor and fear. That the greatest way to fight fear is with jokes. That's what ridiculous is,
Right.
ridiculous and boggarts. And if you look at it from a way of enacting some sort of resistance to authoritarianism, authoritarianism is scary. It's oppressive. It's more than anything else. It's frightening. It's terrifying. And if you can ridicule it with jokes, you can take away its power. But on the other hand, fear is trying to take away your ability to joke around. It's trying to silence Peeves, you know. And so you need to give Peeves the authority to fight that.
Yeah, and I just to go back to what Emily was saying too, Jean Sharp talks about humor and pranks as an excellent nonviolent tool for dealing with authoritarianism because it undercuts the fear, and it
Yeah.
actually builds community.
Yeah, you actually introduced me to Gene Sharp, which is interesting because when I looked him up, he apparently was a professor at my college while I was there.
Oh, that's cool. No, he's really, Gene Sharp. He's a little under the radar. People don't know a lot about him, but his book, he made it free, and it
Yeah.
basically gives you the tools to fight a totalitarian regime, and it's worldwide. People read it like in North
Yeah.
Korea,
And it pops up every once
Wow.
whenever somewhere in the world where the topic of authoritarianism comes up, I forgot how many 101 or whatever it is, ways to fight fascism pops up
And he
and
just
like
lists them out. He just
yeah.
lists out. Here's, you use this and you do this, but you do it, you, it does it, you have to be disciplined about it, and you have to not be provoked into shutting up or into violence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the name of the book?
Po The Politics of Nonviolent Action, I think is the it's like a two volume book. I think the, and then I think it's in the second volume is where he talks about humor. The Politics of Nonviolent Action came out in the 70s, and there may have been more updated versions that contain his list there. But
Yeah,
you'll
there is
see you,
one. There is From Dictatorship to Democracy. I'm just looking at them now. Yeah,
Oh, okay.
there's a ton of these that are available. And like I say, he wanted them to be available, so you can often find them free, in PDF form and so on.
That is just
Yeah.
great, man. Accessibility. And how important that books like that be accessible to people,
Yeah,
A
right.
little pro tip to any of the academic listeners out there. If you're ever looking for any sort of paper, just reach out to the person who wrote it, and a lot
Yeah.
of times they'll give it to
That's right. That's right.
you.
Yeah. Actually, that's a really good tip.
People want people to read their stuff. That's
Yeah.
what we're here for. Yeah. So, I think you've given us a lot of food for thought here, Mark Anthony, and really thinking about humor in a repressive environment and why we're drawn to it, and also some of the pitfalls, some of the complexities. and particularly seeing it through the lens of Harry Potter. Thank you so much for joining us on the show, Mark Anthony.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Mark Anthony, if our listeners want to hear more from you, where should they go?
I have a blog that I haven't touched in a couple of years called Irregardless Magazine.
Really good stuff there, though. For years, there's been good stuff.
Thank you. And I've got, those are more academic things. If you want to see me be funny, you can go to snarkanthony.com or no hyphen. And I've got list of, I don't really have clips online. I may be appearing on a PBS program in the coming months. I won't say what the program is, but I may be appearing on that soon.
Oh, fun.
I'll definitely post about it.
Yeah,
keep us posted because we can push that on our social media.
Oh,
to let people know. Yeah, absolutely.
And it involves a story about someone you two have met. So.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah, I did catch a clip of you, Mark Anthony, where you did like a Harry Potter self-deprecating joke. I don't know.
Yes,
if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, there's a short clip of that. I that joke didn't work out the way I wanted it to, so I don't like that clip that much. But
okay.
but yes, there is on my Instagram. There's a clip of a joke I make about myself.
I like you're blending your Harry Potter scholarly and comedian worlds together there. So.
Mm-hmm. And your Instagram handle is also Snark Anthony.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Yeah.
My name is Mark Anthony. I'm snarky. Snark Anthony. There you go.
Yeah. No, it tracks. Definitely.
Love it. Well, we're going to close today with that passage from when Harry and Ron first visit the Weasley twins at their new joke shop. "Whoa," said Ron, stopping in his tracks. Set against the dull, poster-muffled shop fronts around them, Fred and George's windows hit the eye like a firework display. Casual passers-by were looking back over their shoulders at the windows, and a few rather stunned-looking people had actually come to a halt, transfixed. The left-hand window was dazzlingly full of an assortment of goods that revolved, popped, flashed, bounced, and shrieked. Harry's eyes began to water just looking at it. The right-hand window was covered with a gigantic poster, purple, like those of the ministry, but emblazoned with flashing yellow letters. "Why are you worrying about you-know-who? You should be worrying about you-know-poo, the constipation sensation that's gripping the nation." Harry started to laugh. He heard a weak sort of moan beside him and looked around to see Mrs. Weasley gazing dumbfounded at the poster. Her lips moved silently, mouthing the name, you-know-poo. "They'll be murdered in their beds," she whispered. "No, they won't," said Ron, who, like Harry, was laughing. "This is brilliant."
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburnd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburnd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.